So here we are talking about acts of kindness and the concept of tikkun olam, fixing the world. So basic Judaism class, our third session. So in 2015, immediately after Nepal was hit by one of the most devastating earthquakes ever, Israel sent this IDF relief team to help save people that were trapped under rubble. They set up a field hospital, and there was a 60-bed Israeli hospital that was based in Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, and they were there for 10 days. And there were about 150 medical personnel. They treated hundreds of earthquake victims, carried out 85 surgeries. I don't even know if you know this. This was just from Israel. Israel is consistently one of the first responding countries to devastations like this. And the hospital offered operating rooms and imaging facilities, advanced labs, intensive care section. It also had a synagogue and a kosher kitchen. And when the Israeli medical team came back and returned from their trip, the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, personally greeted them with the following message. He said, welcome. He said, you helped 1,600 wounded people. You have brought new life with at least 8 births. You know, there were Haitians that were naming their children Israel. You have shown the true face of Israel, which is a country that truly values life. And this is not a isolated incident. The IDF has sent medical relief teams to Mexico in 1985, Armenia in 1988, Turkey in 1991, El Salvador, India, and Peru, all in 2001, Indonesia in 2006, 1994, during the Rwanda refugee crisis, Israel initiated Operation Interns for Hope. I don't know if you ever heard of that, where they established a field hospital in neighboring Zaire to bring medical aid to refugees. Israel was also the one to send supplies to Sri Lanka when they had that devastating flood in 2003. And they were among the first 3 countries to provide aid to victims of the 2004 tsunami that ravaged Southeast Asia. 2010, when there was another terrible earthquake in Haiti, a 7.0 level earthquake, Israel sent 250 doctors, nurses, and rescue workers. And it's unbelievable when the newspapers reported on how the mother of the first Haitian child the Israeli team delivered, her name Israel, because of the extraordinary care she was given. My friend, Rabbi Levine, told me this unbelievable story about a religious guy that came to do some fundraising for his yeshiva. He came in from Israel, and his name is Meir. He comes to New York every year to collect money. And he told Rabbi Levine, my friend, that he had rented a car to get around when he was here, and one day he made a mistake. He was driving somewhere, some highway in New Jersey, and he ran out of gas. So he literally ran out of gas and was able to pull the car over on the shoulder. And he's a little frazzled. He's a guy with a long beard. He's like a very yeshivish, like ultra-Orthodox rabbi. Came to New York to raise some money for his yeshiva. He sees his Jeep drive past him onto the shoulder and then start driving in reverse. And he's starting to, like, he's a little excited, but he's a little nervous. And the driver had obviously spotted him. And a black man gets out of the Jeep, asks, this rabbi, what's going on? So Meir starts telling him that he's a visitor from Israel. He ran out of gas, and the driver of the Jeep starts to get all teary-eyed, and he steps forward, and he asks Meir if he can hug him. He was like, okay, let's hug it out. And they hug, and he asks him, why did you want to hug me? And he says, I'm from Haiti. My entire neighborhood was devastated in the earthquake. A lot of my family was killed. We thought the world was coming to an end. And it seemed like nobody was there to help. And then Israel came. And I've never met anyone since then. And when I saw someone who clearly looked Jewish on the side of the road, I never had a chance to say thank you. So the guy pulls over. Didn't help him with gas or anything like that. I mean, he just gave him a hug and left. But if you just think about Israel, is such a tiny country. It gets beaten up a lot at the United Nations. You'd figure we'd be the last people to start sending. I mean, one of the countries we sent equipment and medical personnel teams to is Turkey. Turkey has unfortunately been very negative about Israel in the last close to a decade, unfortunately. And And it's not just what Israel does when they go to other countries. Israel is so proud of the fact that it builds all of this technology that can be exported to the world. They were the first ones, by the way, to develop the first fully computerized, no radiation diagnostic technology to detect breast cancer. Israel, by the way, developed the cell phone and most of the Windows operating systems. The Pentax MMX chip that is found in much of our technology was also developed in Israel. I mean, one thing after the next. And the question, is this just because we like making a lot of money? Jews like having money. We just want to be prominent. But if you ask people, a lot of the people who are these scientists working in these laboratories are trying to make the world a better place. And it's no wonder that so many Nobel Peace Prize winners are Jewish. We are 1/5 of 1% of the world's population, and yet Jews have won 20% of the Nobel Prizes in chemistry, 26% in physics, 27% in medicine, 41% in economics. Now, where does that come from? Oh, we're smart. Okay, there are a lot of other smart people in the world, too. They say that 3 out of the 4 people who most influenced Western thought in the 20th century were Jewish, and the one guy who wasn't was wrong. They said, talking about, Albert Einstein, Karl Marx, Sigmund Freud, and Charles Darwin. I don't know, maybe you think Marx was wrong, but Darwin gets a lot of flack for some of his theories. Some of it has been accepted in science, some not. But the biggest law firms and the most prominent universities, the best hospitals, all have disproportionate numbers of Jews. And most human rights and civil rights movements are led by Jews, statistically, consistently. And the question is this some kind of coincidence? We just happen to be out there. Is this something that Jews just happen to do? Are we just more an industrious, more ambitious people? And I photocopied a couple of sources for you to look at. Because what I want to do tonight with you is start on the macro level and then get down to the micro. You don't have a handout. Let me give you a handout. Which is to start from what we are supposed to do as a nation and as a people, and then what we do as individuals. Oh, would you like? There's no technical... How many commandments are there in the Bible, in the Torah? 613. So where is the commandment that says, fix the world? Is there such a thing? When there's a tsunami, be there. Is there like a technical mitzvah? So there's actually no technical mitzvah to fix the world. It's not one of the Ten Commandments. It's not even technically listed as one of the 613. Bettering the world, though, is a religious imperative that seems to be strewn throughout biblical and rabbinic literature, so much so that I would call it sort of a meta-issue in Judaism, an overarching theme and value of Torah. And it's not something, by the way, that should replace other mitzvot. And I want to say this because this has happened in some Jewish denominations where it becomes the whole religion. Judaism is not about Shabbat anymore. It's not about keeping kosher. It's not about, not speaking ill. It's just about fixing the world. And we've made this into a religion too. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't speak about it because it's a big, big part of our religion, clearly. Now, where does this come from? It comes from all over the Torah. And I would like to run through just a couple of sources with you that teach about, take a look at source number one. I am the Lord, I have called you with righteousness, I will strengthen your hand, I will protect you, I formed you, and I made you as a covenant to the people for a light to the nations. This is a famous verse from the prophet Isaiah. What does that mean to a light amongst the nations? Now this is really important. How do Jews become a light to the world? Now you could just say by going in and helping people, just rolling up your sleeves and helping. But the commentaries say that we have something very specific that others do not have, that we're supposed to share. Where do we get the inspiration to go send those medical teams from? And it's from the Torah. The Radak, one of the commentators, say that what is the light? The light is the Torah, which is why if you start playing with the Torah too much, or you disregard the rest of the Torah and you just say, be a light amongst the nations, then what exactly are you illuminating the world with? What's unique about the Jew is this whole thing called the Torah. Now, that doesn't mean we have a responsibility to start getting everybody to keep Shabbos. We're not a proselytizing people. And we don't go to other parts of the world just to help people so we can get in there to change them theologically. That's what Christian missionaries do, and God bless them, because they do a lot of good. But a lot of it is being done for the sake of sort of converting people to a certain way of thinking. We do a little of that, but it's much more subtle, meaning we don't have to try to get the world to start keeping Shabbat, keeping kosher. That's for the Jews. We're supposed to try to get all of humanity to live the seven Noahide laws. Anybody know what the seven Noahide laws are? Do you know them? Well, you're close, but they're not. You would think they would encompass the Ten Commandments. They actually don't. That's a good guess, though. For example, one of the Ten Commandments is love, is honor your mother and your father. That's not one of the seven Noahide laws. One of the Noahide laws is not to rip a limb off a living animal. Kind of specific. It's not one of the Ten Commandments. Right? Cruelty to animals is a prohibition for all people, not just Jews. Believing in God, believe it or not, is one of the seven Noahide laws. Not blaspheming God's name. Not blaspheming God's name. Not to steal. Not to engage in sexual immorality. Not to kill. And not to... And a mitzvah, and a positive commandment to set up a legal system.
Where do they come from?
Very good. In the Torah there. Anybody? Who was Noah? We call him the seven Noahide laws.
Yeah.
So Noah was not Jewish. The first Jew in the Bible was Abraham. So Noah was a righteous person who was not yet, who was not Jewish, not yet. He was never meant to be Jewish, but he was a righteous individual. We believe that those seven laws were given at the time of Noah already. That they go back even before the Torah was revealed to the Jews, the seven Noahide laws were given. By the way, by the time the Torah was given, Jews were keeping how many commandments? By the time the Torah was given at Sinai, the Jews were given eight, the seven Noahide laws, plus bris milah, plus circumcision. God told Abraham to circumcise himself. But those seven Noahide laws were in existence, we believe, from the very beginning of the world. Well, not the very beginning, but the times of Noah. Okay. And that's something we're supposed to try to share with the rest of the world. Here's another verse. Take a look at source number 3. Supposed to be a kingdom of priests. And now if you listen well to me and observe my covenant. Anybody want to read that? Actually, let's go to 4. And now, we got our volunteer, go for it.
And now if you listen well to me and observe my covenant, you shall be to me the most beloved treasure of all peoples, for mine is the entire world. You shall to me a kingdom of priests for the reed.
Yeah, you shall be to me, sorry.
You shall be to me a kingdom of priests in the nation. Use the words that you shall speak to the children of Israel.
Now, what does it mean to be a kingdom of priests in a holy nation? Does that sound a little chauvinistic for you? You're special. Chosen. What does that mean? How are we special or chosen? Do we believe in that? Do we believe we're chosen?
Bring the light onto the nations?
Right, so here's the analogy I like to use. You've all been to school, hopefully, at some point in your life. So, did you ever think the teacher was being a little pompous or arrogant by sitting up front, like I'm doing right now, behind the podium here, I'm lecturing you, you're the student, I'm the teacher? Why is that? Why is that like, am I being arrogant by doing that? Or any teacher, first grade, second grade, high school, college professor, why is that cool? Why does it not somehow make the professor, the teacher, filled with himself? I mean, you have something to share. Everyone in this room probably knows a ton of things I don't know, I maybe will never learn.
So they walk into their room under the tacit agreement. That's
yeah.
The expectation.
So you're saying we just have an agreement. The teacher actually is just as much of an idiot as the students. But we have an agreement.
Maybe so. Maybe. Or even because to argue that, oh, it's only because the teacher is smarter than...
Right.
And that would be assuming, well, anytime someone's smarter, they could possibly have. But, yeah,
so it's not smarter. What is it? Why do we have this agreement? Because in the subject matter. The subject matter, whatever it is, it could be arithmetic for third graders. It could be neuroscience for MIT PhD candidates. Doesn't matter. In this case, I'm supposed to know a little something more than you guys about Torah, so I'm going to share it. That doesn't make me arrogant. That makes me kind of nice that I'm sharing it. Or maybe I'm not so nice. I need to make the money. The $7 you guys paid, I'm just, you know, living it up. Whatever. I'm trying to keep you guys up. But this is important. A lot of people feel very put off by this. You're a light amongst the nations. Why are you a light amongst the nations? What do you have that the rest of the world doesn't have? How we're supposed to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. What is it that the Jewish people possess that makes us somehow worthy of being that teacher? That we sit here and the rest of the world is over there and we're supposed to be okay with it. What is it?
The Torah.
Right, so theoretically it's the Torah. This is why we have to be very careful, in my opinion, that we don't simply take everybody else's wisdom and just call it Judaism and then package that to the world. Because then we're not really sharing our gift, what is uniquely Jewish. You don't need a Jew to do that. You can have other people who have that. Now, there happen to be things that the Torah teaches that the world embraces. A lot of it is because we live in a Western society, which flows from a certain Judeo-Christian ethic. Some of it just comes from the Torah, and we were born into that. But we should never think that somehow we're better. We should feel privileged that we were given this gift. It's like someone buys you a book. And you read it, and your friend never got. No one ever bought your friend the book, so now you're a big shot, and your friend's not. No, you got the book. He didn't get the book. So share the wisdom. But it's all about sharing. It's not about imposing. Judaism was never about coercing people into doing things they don't want to do. It's sharing. Everyone has to decide what they want to do with the information themselves. Take a look at source number 6 on the bottom. The Sfarno says. Look at number 5, where I underlined it, the congregation's role model. We're supposed to role model. By the way, preaching, I will tell you as a parent, is sometimes the worst thing to do. You know, you're in a classroom right now, so I'm teaching. But what's the best way for any kid to learn? What's the best way, the least off-putting way to get other people to do things?
Just kidding.
What's that, what you say?
Learn by
experience. Yeah, by actually doing it yourself. Walking the walk. Because I know that my kids usually will ignore most of what I have to say, but when they were little at least, and to a certain degree still, they mimic. They ape what their parents do. It's really a fascinating thing because kids know that talk is cheap, and the most important thing, if you want to, and if you think about it, how do we do that in Judaism? How do we actually teach ideas, values? By getting up in 42nd Street on a soapbox and start telling people, thou shalt this, thou shalt that, don't do this, do that. That's not effective. I've seen those guys. I don't think they're doing well. What is effective? What's effective is if you have an entire nation that is once a week pulling back. We had a discussion last week about Shabbos. And all of a sudden, it just sort of makes an impact on our neighbors. First, our Jewish neighbors. And then perhaps our fellow non-Jewish neighbors, not to start keeping Shabbos. But maybe they put the cell phones down during dinner every night and do a little Shabbos for an hour. And if we start we start refraining from speaking ill of each other, and we do this and we're careful about it, and people see we're careful about it, what impact can that have on people? I will tell you, a much greater impact than saying it. It's forbidden to speak ill of others. Okay, what does that do? But you see someone who's really struggling with it and trying to observe these laws, that can go a long way. So look at number 6. That's number 5. That's the role modeling. Number 6, teach the entire human race to call on the name of God. We are supposed to be an inspiration for people to believe and to have some kind of relationship with God. Look at number 7. Turn the page. To be an illumination to the nations to cause them to arrive at the knowledge of the Lord of the universe. These are different tasks that we have based on this verse, these verses that we're reading. Why are we called a kingdom of priests? I know you think of a priest, you think of Christianity. What's the Hebrew word for a priest in Judaism? What do we call a priest in Judaism? With a K.
Kohen.
A Kohen. Good. What is a Kohen? We're supposed to be the Kohanim for the world. What is the Kohen's role in the Jewish community? The Kohen's role in the Jewish community was to be the teacher. There was a certain segment of the Jewish community that was supposed to be dedicated to teaching the children and role modeling for the adults as well. And so just like you have that subgroup of Jews called Kohanim that are supposed to live a certain purer type of existence within the Jewish world, so too are the Jewish people supposed to be the Kohanim of the world. Again, not preaching, not imposing, living a certain life, other people see this. By the way, where is the ideal place that this is supposed to be looked at? Which part of the world?
Israel.
Because there's a famous verse in the Torah, Ki Mitzion Teitzei Torah, because from Zion goes forth Torah. Israel is supposed to be just like an unbelievable example. That's why there was a big controversy in the 1980s, whether or not El Al, which was at that time a national-owned airline by the state of Israel, should fly on the Sabbath or not. Of course, many of the El Al workers who were not Sabbath observant wanted, because it would have cost a lot of money. Menachem Begin was the prime minister. There's a very eloquent speech he gave in the Knesset arguing that even if you're not Sabbath observant, the state of Israel, the people of Israel, are supposed to kind of represent certain ideals. And if we tell the whole world we don't care about Shabbat because we can make a few extra bucks by flying on Saturdays also, then what kind of role modeling are we doing? It was a huge controversy. People got up and walked out on him. It ended up, he ended up convincing. So now they do.
Wait, really?
Because it's privately owned. It's not owned by the government anymore.
That changed, I don't know, how long ago did El Al go private?
I don't know.
A couple of years ago, not so long ago.
Very recent, like within the last 10 years. I don't know, maybe I'm wrong. I could be wrong. When it was a national airline, it never flew on Shabbat. That's the whole tension that Israel has to deal with. But the idea that the Jewish people are supposed to represent and be a light amongst the nations somehow is a very, very, really, really important idea. And we're supposed to have a reputation of doing this. I'll tell you a story that my dad actually told, and I heard it for the first time in this room, at my oldest son's bar mitzvah. And he told the story about his father, about my grandfather. I have this in my book. My dad's an immigration lawyer for many, many years, and somebody once called him about his grandson, who was from England, and wanted to bring his grandson to the United States for Passover. And he called my dad to see if he can get him a visa, which was not so simple, because he had some immigration issue. So my father called a member of his association in Ohio, where the swearing-in was supposed to take place. In other words, this person called my father to get his grandchildren sworn in as citizens while they were still in America, for Passover. They were here visiting, and he wanted to get them sworn in to save the whole cost and hassle of bringing them back in on another occasion. And my father's colleague in Ohio said that the mayor, the congressman, all the senators tried doing it. It can't be done. Don't waste your time. It takes months to get an appointment. So my father tried one more thing. He simply called, this is years ago when it was called the INS. It's now Homeland Security. He called the INS, and he was put in touch with a guy by the name of Inspector Kowalczyk. Kowalczyk gets on the phone. He says, look, I'm a deportation officer. I don't handle citizenship, but I don't think it can be done. And before he hung up the phone, my father said, you know, I come from a small town in Pennsylvania. My dad was raised in a little hick town in Pennsylvania called Oliphant, Pennsylvania. It was like population 20. It was tiny. I used to go there when I was a kid. And I remember there was a Kowalczyk. There was a Kowalczyk in Oliphant. So Kowalczyk, he says, you know, they had like a store there. And Kowalczyk interrupts. He goes, yeah, furniture store. My mother still lives there. So my dad's like, oh, he's like, how do you know Oliphant? So my father's like, I'm from there also. My dad also had a store. So Kowalczyk says, all right, let me see what I can do. You know, there's a term in Yiddish called a landsman. When you meet somebody who's from the same town, like in Poland as you were, there's an immediate connection. It happens. So a couple of days later, Kowalczyk calls my father. And he says, who's Harry Wiles? So Harry Wiles was my grandfather, my dad's father. So my father says, that was my father. Kowalczyk says, my mother's in her 90s. I called her. And I said, did you ever hear of a Wiles? And right away she said, Harry Wilds, yeah, he's the honest Jew. So Kowalczyk then tells my dad this story that he had never heard. And I heard it for the first time here at my son's bar mitzvah. So my grandfather had a little store, and he also would peddle merchandise he couldn't sell in the store. And he says that your grandfather came as a peddler to my mother's home. It was actually quite a distance from Oliphant. And she bought a house dress from him and gave your father a $20 bill. It's a lot of money in those days. But my grandfather, Harry, gave her back change as though she had only given him $10, not $20. He made a mistake. And it was only when he got home he realized he had given her the wrong change. So around midnight, my grandfather went all the way back to her home, knocked on her door, woke her up to give her the $10. And she never forgot that, Kowalczyk said to my father. Look, Kowalczyk said, there's not much I can do about this case, but the least I can do for Harry Wilde's son, he says, is to try. And sure enough, he got it done. You know, somehow he was able to get this favor for the family, and the guy, the grandson, was sworn in. And these little things people remember. I'll tell you one other quick story that makes impressions. When we live in a certain way, when we behave in a certain way, it makes an impression on people. It's not what you say, it's what you do. There was a woman who used to come to MGE. She was a doctor. And when I asked her what inspired her to become religious, she wasn't raised in a religiously observant home. She said that when she was in medical school and they brought out the cadavers, she remembers that everybody was like very nonchalant. Like in the beginning, the first 5-10 minutes, everybody was very respectful because it's a little weird. And then after a few minutes, people just were themselves around the cadaver as they were doing whatever they were doing to learn how to become doctors. And she said there was this one guy with a kippah who never spoke in the presence of the cadaver. And whenever he had to say something, he said it in a very few words, in a very, very respectful and low tone. And when she learned that his sensitivity was due to his religious background, it inspired her to delve deeper. And that's really what it means to model a certain kind of behavior. Being sort of an ambassador, sending a team, a relief team to a country, discovering cures, not simply to make money, because you want to make the world a better place. This is the kind of reputation the Jewish people are supposed to have. Unfortunately, we have a reputation of being really wealthy and influential. Now, there's nothing wrong with being wealthy, you know, as long as you do good with the money, you can do a lot of good with a lot of money. As long as people understand that the money is just a tool. It's not about the money. It's about making the world a better place. And it's also about teaching the world about a one God and ethical monotheism. And here, our impact, if you think about it, has really been amazing. Because if it wasn't for Judaism, there would be no Christianity and there would be no Islam. And so there are billions of people who believe in a one and only God, maybe with some diversions in the Christian tradition, depending on your denomination, because we have modeled that for all of society. I want to mention one other thing that I want to get a little more specific. And that comes to Passover. Why do we make such a big deal that we were slaves? I mean, Passover Seder is the most ritually observed Jewish tradition in America. Something like 70% of American Jews have a Seder. Just to give you a sense, 22% of American Jews light Shabbat candles. So it's way up there. And we think about the Exodus all the time. It's all over our liturgy. Every time we pray, we sit down, we eat a meal, we recite the grace after meals, we say Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, to remember the Exodus from Egypt. We make Kiddush on Friday night on Shabbat, Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, to remember the Exodus from Egypt. Then we sit down and have a Seder where we reenact it, and we lean, and we eat this matzah, and the maror, like that we were still slaves. Why are we so obsessed over the fact that we were once slaves? I mean, that was a really long time ago. Move on. We're not the only nation to have been enslaved, unfortunately, and subsequently emancipated, but nobody dwells on it like we do. And Rabbi Soloveitchik, take a look at your handout. Really beautiful line. If you take a look on page 3, this is a quote. We got another volunteer? Go for it. Take a look at 14.
You shall not pervert the justice due to a stranger or to the fatherless, nor take a widow's garment in pawn. Remember that you were a slave in Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you to observe this commandment.
Good. Keep reading. Those are verses from Deuteronomy, from the Bible. Listen to what Rabbi Soloveitchik has to say about it. Keep reading, please.
Whenever the Torah wants to impress upon us the mitzvah of having compassion for the oppressed in society, it reminds us of similar helplessness and lowly status during our bondage in Egypt. The stranger, in particular, personifies the helpless one who has no family or friends to intercede on his behalf. For this reason, as the Talmud indicates, the Torah exhorts us in 36 scriptural references to treat the stranger kindly.
Okay, excellent. So why were we strangers? Why were we slaves, says Rabbi Soloveitchik? The fact that we began as a nation of slaves embedded within us some kind of DNA, some kind of national consciousness of, you know, we are the world's bleeding heart liberal. We are. We could be very proud of that, as long as we don't allow it to obscure other values. It's actually an amazing thing. Now, when you're the subject of abuse, it can go either way. God forbid, and we have a lot of statistics and unfortunately studies to show that a lot of people who are abused end up becoming abusers. But some people who are abused end up learning from that and become righteous individuals and use that negative experience in their youth to actually do good. That's what we were supposed to do with it. The stranger in particular personifies the helpless one who has no family or friends. And that's why the Talmud tells us 36 times, who's the stranger, the person who converts to Judaism? Why is it so important to treat someone who converted to Judaism with such utmost care and kindness? Because they don't have the support system everybody else does. The orphan, the widow, and the stranger. The ger yatom and almana, those are the three categories that receive extra special protection in the Torah. I want to tell you one last thing here, then we're going to get to something more specific. It's a great story. I got this from Rabbi Jonathan Sachs's book. If you want to get a book on some of this, it's really, really great. Maybe we'll send this out in the bibliography. It's called, I think we have it here, like To Heal a Fractured World or something like that. Look at that. It's an amazing book. To Heal a Fractured World. Jonathan Sachs. And in this book he writes, take a look on the bottom of page 3. Nothing in contemporary secular conversation calls us to give up anything truly valuable for anybody else. Only religion offers a sacred language of sacrifice, selflessness, awe that enables believers to treat their fellow citizens as fellow passengers. Now, I'm quoting from Stephen Carter, who is quoted in this book. He wrote a whole book called Civility. You gotta listen to this. It's very powerful. He says, basically, religion gives you a way and compels you, I don't know, compels or challenges us to treat our fellow citizens as fellow passengers. But even if religion is the engine of civility, it has too few serious practitioners, which is why those who are truly moved by it to love their fellow human beings are so special. I learned that truth in 1966, and to this day I can close my eyes and feel on my tongue, the smooth, slick sweetness of the cream cheese and jelly sandwich that I gobbled on that summer afternoon when I discovered how a single act of genuine and unassuming civility can change a life forever. Now, I didn't tell you the backstory. Stephen Carter was an African-American, and he was 11 years old when his family moved to an all-white neighborhood in Washington. And he vividly remembers sitting on the porch with his two brothers and two sisters waiting to see how they would be greeted in their new neighborhood. And as all the passerbyers either stared at them or just ignored them, nobody came to say hello except this one white woman. Their next door neighbor walked over to the kids and with a broad smile said welcome and brought them drinks and cream cheese and jelly sandwiches. And that moment, he said, that changed his life, because at that moment, he said, when race relations in America were pretty awful, he realized that a black family could feel at home in a white neighborhood. And he's a professor of law at Yale today, Stephen Carter, and he wrote this book called Civility. And of course, who was the person that brought him the cream cheese and jelly sandwich? Her name was Sarah Kestenbaum, and he adds in his book that she was a religious Jew. In the Jewish tradition, Carter says, quote, such civility is called chesed, the doing of acts of kindness, which is in turn derived from the understanding that human beings are made in the image of God. Now, what is the source for chesed? What is the source for chesed, for doing acts of kindness? Take a look on page 4. We're continuing. Get a volunteer and I'll read number 20.
Sure. You shall not take revenge and you shall not bear a grudge against the members of your people. You shall love your fellow as yourself. I am Hashem.
Now that verse and that phrase, love thy neighbor as thyself, was actually taken from last week's Parsha, Parshat Kedoshim, the book of Leviticus, chapter 19, verse 18. What does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? That's like a very vague kind of thing. And does the Torah really mean what it says? I mean, is it possible for any one of us to truly love another person as much as we love ourselves? Chase, what do you think?
I think you've also argued that there's no imperative in Judaism for forgiveness in any way. So turning cheek is pretty much a Christian.
Yeah.
One.
Well, there is an imperative to forgive if the person asking for forgiveness
right.
is contrite and is sincere.
Okay.
Then you're supposed to try to forgive. The difference between Judaism and Christianity comes when the person is not contrite and they don't ask for forgiveness and they continue their misconduct. A good Christian turns the other cheek and realizes that because we're all sinners, the person can't really help themselves, and therefore an act of forgiveness is really an act of heroism. In Judaism, we don't believe in that. We believe that's an abdication of responsibility. You have no responsibility to forgive someone unless they say and mean that they're sorry. But if they do mean it, and they really want your forgiveness, and they cease from the inappropriate behavior, then you should try to forgive them. Question.
I'm just remembering the bedtime Shema instructs Jews to give forgiveness every night.
It does. There's a very beautiful, Daniel's mentioning a little prayer that's said right before the bedtime Shema, where you sort of forgive everybody that's messed you up a little. It's a kind of a small version of a larger prayer that we say before Yom Kippur. But that is assuming... That is assuming the other person feels badly about what they have done. You don't technically have to do that. You don't. It's a nice thing to do, and actually it's very healthy not to carry around ill will for other people. But you don't technically have to forgive someone unless they really ask for it and want it. What you're doing in that prayer is giving it anyway, which is a good thing if you can do it, but you don't have to. Now, Chase, while you're bringing this up now, you're bringing up the forgiveness because you're saying, how does it conflict with this? You had a good point. You were. That's why I'm coming back to you now.
I thought of it as conflicting.
Conflicting with love thy neighbor. Because love thy neighbor seems to imply always love everybody no matter what.
Yeah.
What if your neighbor's evil? You have to love them? No. In fact, sometimes hate is an appropriate emotion. Hitler and the Nazis would go unopposed if we just loved everybody. You can't love everybody. You're not supposed to love bad people. You're supposed to change bad people, help them get better. I've always said this when my kids were little. You know, when I'm a big superhero. I love super. I just saw the NBC Avengers.
Yes.
It's only like 3 hours long. It was good, no?
Great. Well, I saw it twice.
You saw it twice.
Yeah.
But I waited, and nothing happened at the end. I waited for all those credits. That's like 15 minutes of credits.
But something did happen. You hear the hammer from the first Iron Man.
Oh, right. 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 That was cool.
There's a trailer at the end of all the credits.
Not an Endgame.
Yeah.
Wait.
For the next Iron Man.
Oh.
They just edited it last Friday.
Okay. All right. Good. I'm speaking amongst my people here. I like this. So I always said that, you know, what would be better than Superman pummeling somebody, the bad guy? The bad guy repenting. The bad guy saying, "You know, I need to do better." And by the way, that's why superheroes are so awesome, particularly Batman, because he has like depending on which version, but he has a real dark side. Superman is always, you know, I never really loved Superman as much because Batman really struggled. He could have gone to the dark side, you know, the Fantastic Four? There were five dudes that went up there and got frazzled by nuclear something or other, but four of them used it for the good and one not. Why are we talking about Superman here? Oh, because the idea that loving your neighbor as yourself, that doesn't imply that everyone is worthy of that love. It doesn't imply that everyone's worthy of love. If the person is committing an act of, you know, some kind of evil act, you have to oppose it, and you can't really oppose it if you love them. It doesn't work that way. And that's not what the Torah is trying to teach. What it's trying to teach is somebody that's worthy. Now, generally, people are, unless they do something really awful to prove themselves unworthy, but they can do what's called tshuva. They can repent by asking you for forgiveness and stopping, desisting the disgraceful behavior. But if they don't do that, then there's no love. There's no such obligation. My question is it really possible to actually love your neighbor as yourself? So, yeah.
You talked about Judaism is about action more so than beliefs, and maybe it's in treating the person the way you want to be treated.
Good. That's what a lot of the rabbis teach. A lot of the rabbis say, very well said, that can't really emotionally love someone else like you love you. But what you can do is, and some of the commentaries explain, if there, let's say you have a friend who's ill, God forbid. What you do is you put yourself in their situation. If I was ill, what would I want my friends to do for me? I would want them to visit me. I would want them to pray for me. And then you go ahead and love your neighbor as yourself means ask yourself, if you were, God forbid, in that situation, what would you do? What would you want for you? And start thinking of other people like you think of yourself. But it's not like you really love them like you love yourself, but you're starting to treat them behaviorally as you would want to be treated in a given scenario. Although Maimonides, the great Jewish philosopher, seemed to take it literally. Look what he writes. It's a positive mitzvah. I'll get to that in a second. And I'm sorry, I'll read that in 1 second. But I want to give you a hint. There is an answer. How can you actually emotionally love other people the same degree you love yourself? And there's something in the verse that's very subtle at the end that answers the question. How does the verse conclude? What does it say after love? Love your neighbor as yourself.
I am Hashem.
Yeah. What is that? We're in the book of Leviticus now. We've had many chapters with God. Why does God have to tell us, by the way, I'm God? It's like weird. I mean, we've been talking to God for like...
Because everybody's created in His image.
Very good. And therefore?
By reminding us that He is Hashem, then He's reminding us that, you know, like loving others and yourself, you're kind of loving God or something.
Good, good. Yeah, Chase?
I'm going to introduce a secular concept. Person does something wrong, you tell them they do something wrong. You know, a person usually isn't fired from work until, you know, they've been told that their bad behavior is as he said. And you made this point a few weeks ago that God multiple times says, you know, I am God, or sorry, God multiple times re-presents the covenant again. So I guess maybe following on the forgiveness theme that I brought up, I'll confess, but maybe there's the idea that love your fellow as yourself. You know, what's the opposite of love? Hate. You know, someone has to do something to generate it. That there should be some window of allowing someone to...
allowing...
On the right time.
Yeah, no, I understand. I think I'm following. In other words, allowing people to...
The idea is that, you know, if Hashem needed to remind people that here is your covenant, you know, mm-hmm. there's a recognition that, you know...
But let me ask you this. Yeah. Let me ask you this, because you're both starting to dance around a little.
Yeah.
When we say love your neighbor as yourself, it's implying that there's what?
Love for yourself.
What does that mean? What aspect of yourself are you supposed to love? How much money we have? I said this, I did this, I do a little Parsha video every week. This was my Parsha video last week. What we look like? What's that?
Your soul.
Yeah. In other words, our job is to cultivate the deeper part of who we are and love that. And that could be an answer to the question. If you can love your soul, then that might enable you to love other people because that's what we have in common with everyone else. The only thing that divides us and distinguishes us is what we look like, our attitudes, our predispositions, but the soul is a soul. The soul is an expression of God. And if you love your soul, then what's stopping you from loving other souls? That's the great, great equalizer. And by the way, why do you believe in human rights? If you don't subscribe to a belief in a higher being called God, what is the reason that you should treat other human beings in a better fashion than, let's say, an animal?
You say the law necessitates it.
The law?
You better off.
I'm asking philosophically or morally. Oh, the law, so they'll be thrown in jail. And you'll be like, what do you mean? He's no different than a chicken. This is what I do with my baby, with the chicken. I'm doing this with a person. No, the law says you have to treat people differently than chickens. Why?
But wait a second, because human rights are not necessarily in opposition to animal rights. You could believe in human rights and also believe in animal rights and kind of think that there's not such a big difference.
Good, but by the way, why would you even believe in an animal right?
Also, there's a totally non-religious utilitarian argument for treating humans well.
Which is?
Do not inflict pain. Why? Well, how could you justify that, even if you're secular?
You could totally justify that. Because under certain circumstances, it pays, both financially and in other ways, to inflict pain on other people.
But it has to be financial. For example, utilitarianism was the first argument, you know, supporting gays because they're not hurting anybody,
mm-hmm.
right? So if there's no financial gain there, but there's kind of this utilitarian idea that if you're not hurting anyone, right, it's two people for their own accord.
But what would you say to...
At the time, there's no argument of immorality there. That's an utilitarian argument for...
There's no argument of immorality for...
For being homosexual.
Yeah, but you don't even have to go that far. How would you respond to someone that said, we're gonna treat white people like this, we're gonna treat black people like this, or gay people like this, whatever the division? What is it that gives everyone the right to be treated in a certain kind of way? What is it? You have to point to something that is beyond my personal taste, because those things change.
So I think a secular person would say that society is best off with these rules, right? So without religion, you still have respect for other people.
Why?
Because once upon a time, you didn't have that, and society was, you know, Neanderthals walking around, and then civilization said, okay, if we're going to, you know, succeed, we need to work together as a team, and here's how we got to
work the historical as a team, basis. Right? But the historical basis for that respect is embedded in religion.
What I'm saying is, without religion, if a group of people got together 10,000 years ago, they'd realize, okay, if we actually want to continue to thrive, we can't just kill each other.
Yeah, but you want to know something? There are things that are more valuable to people than survival. The Japanese kamikaze pilots who strap themselves to the planes, or suicide bombers, somehow believe that they're going to go to a better place in this world. And the impetus to simply survive is not a paramount value for everyone. That's what you're a Western-thinking, rational person, right? So you think that way. But other people don't.
But all the people who did think that way were able to continue living because they thought that way.
Yeah, but you know.
The people who, 10,000 years ago, 100,000 years ago, if they didn't think that way, they all died out.
Well, they killed each other. Well, they killed each other. If you keep, that's one of, remember our first class 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago was about God. I gave you two approaches to the belief in a supernatural God. There was a third approach I left out, and that is it's the argument of morality. Because you can, there's no way, I was looking for the book over here. It's in Lawrence Kellerman's Permission to Believe. There needs to be some kind of moral arbiter that's beyond your opinion and my opinion as to why life is valuable for both of us, that we can subscribe to and say life is always the most valuable under all circumstances and all times, or else it's just going to come down to whatever particular society you live in and what their values are, and that keeps changing. So I personally think that that's the reason why love your neighbor as yourself is because I am Hashem, because there's a belief in something beyond us that commands us all, you know. And if you don't subscribe to that, then somebody can come along and make a rational argument that killing a certain group of people might be smarter, you know. Or let's say a group of people are just they're dragging down society, and they're not terribly intelligent, they're not holding their own weight. Maybe we should, you know...
This is so applicable to last night's episode of Game of Thrones.
Missed it. Okay, but take a look at 20. It is, and this is what I want, just the last few minutes we're going to finish up. I want to make this a little practical. How do you love your neighbor as yourself? Look at number 20, the Rambam, or 21. It is a positive mitzvah for the rabbis to visit the sick, to bring comfort to the mourners, to help remove the dead from the home, to help bring the bride to her wedding, accompany guests into your house, participate with them with all their needs. Now, these are examples of acts of kindness in Judaism. How do you fulfill the command, love your neighbor? It's by doing these specific things. If, God forbid, somebody's sick, go to the hospital and visit them. If, God forbid, someone has lost a loved one, we pay a shiva call. We go to the home, we sit there, and by the way, there's a whole section in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, governing each one of these rules and each one of these areas of kindness. It's different, by the way, when you visit someone who's ill than if you're visiting someone who's lost a loved one. Does anybody know the difference when you go visit someone who's ill as opposed to paying a shiva call, God forbid? You know the major difference, and you can study each. There are sections in the Talmud that talk about this. So, for example, what's your goal when you visit someone who's sick? Just a quick little thing for you. If you're going to do this mitzvah, it's very important. Your goal is to try to cheer them up a little. Now, one way of cheering somebody up is to just listen to them and be an empathetic, active listener. But it's also to remind them of other positive things going in their life so they can take the illness and put it in its proper perspective. And therefore, it's a good idea to talk about, oh, how's your cousin this, and how's this project you're working on, how are your children, and not dwell on all the medications and all the problems. You have to do some of that, because they want to be heard. Very different than paying what's called a shiva call. If someone, God forbid, passed away, there, what are you doing? There, you're really trying to listen to them process the death of a loved one. And you don't want to change the subject. That's what everyone does when they go to a shiva call, by the way, because nobody can take it. It's just too, start talking about this, start talking about that. And meanwhile, the person is sitting there. They get this 1 week of an opportunity, according to Jewish tradition, to get it off their chest and to talk about their feelings of their loss, which is very, very important. So in one area you want to focus, one area you want to distract. What's another mitzvah? To help bring the bride to her wedding. What is that? There is such a mitzvah? To help bring a bride to her wedding, what does that mean? You know, call an Uber for her? What does that mean, to help bring the bride to her wedding? It's actually to help somebody get married. Somebody doesn't have the money to get married, to go out and raise the money. Or you can fulfill that mitzvah by buying them a present. Something practical, something that they can use for their new home. It's considered a mitzvah. Also, when you go to a wedding, you have a job. It's not to get smashed. You can drink a little, but you go to a wedding to make the bride and the groom happy. Also, when you invite people into your home, that's called hachnasat orchim, inviting guests in your home. It's a very important mitzvah. These are all the physical acts of kindness. There are no limits to what one must do to fulfill these requirements. Even though all these commandments are from the sages, the rabbis, they're all included in the commandment to love your neighbor as yourself. All of the things that you wish others to do for you, I mean, who wouldn't want these things done for them? What's the most important thing, God forbid, when someone loses a loved one, that they don't feel alone? What's the most important thing when they're celebrating a happy occasion, that they celebrate with their friends? Who makes the simcha? Who makes the happy occasion happy? It's the friends who show up. Right? It's not the money, it's not the hall, it's not the caterer, it's the friends that come. It's a very, very important. So these are specific acts of kindness. Look at bottom of page 4, we're finishing up. Visiting the sick, attending to the dead. Tending to the dead, by the way, is different than comforting the mourner. That means helping with the burial. If somebody doesn't have the money for that, it's considered a great mitzvah to help them. Comforting the mourner, bringing joy to the bride and groom, hospitality to guests. And we spoke about kindness to the widow, orphan, and strangers. Pursuing peace. What is pursuing peace? There is such a mitzvah to pursue peace. These are things for every ordinary people to do. How do you pursue peace? So who was the paradigm of pursuing peace in the Torah? Aaron, Moses' brother. He was called a Rodef Shalom. A lot of synagogues named after that. Rodef Shalom. He pursued peace. He would find two people in the camp that were arguing with each other in a fight. He'd go over to one and say, you know, Bob, who you're having this fight with, you know, he really wants to come clean. He feels badly, but he's not, he doesn't, you know, he's just feeling very awkward. He would tell the other person the same thing. He would just get people together. I wonder if we ever try to do that. Because it happens, you know, we get caught up in just the opposite. You know, we exacerbate things. You see two people fighting, it's a mitzvah to break it up or to try to help them reconcile. Okay. One other thing I want to mention, that is on the other handout, and then we're gonna conclude. The other handout, I gave you that one sheet. Take a look, it's really beautiful. Conclusion. It's number 4 on the bottom. This is a quote from the great German Jewish philosopher, Rav Hirsch. He said, "If you want to see man as the true image of his Father in heaven, you must behold him as he, filled with pity, with love, with divine spirit, makes bread for the hungry, takes care as of a father of the infant's well-being and education, nurses the sick, clothes the naked, comforts the suffering, buries the dead, advises the inexperienced, reconciles those at variance." We just talked about that. "And everywhere strives by word and deed to allay suffering, to heal the injured heart, and to dry the flowing tears. And when roused by such sublime vision, come forward, young maiden, and in the sight of God, come forward, young man, come forward, young maiden, in the sight of God, dedicate yourself with all that noble, beautiful strength with which He has endowed you to such work of love for the salvation of His children." Really, really beautiful. Chesed is an incredibly important part of being Jewish. That's why I wanted to devote an entire class. I'll end also with a psalmist. King David wrote, and it's in the book of Tehillim, "Olam chesed yibaneh." The world was built on kindness. Why did God create the universe? Why did God will us into existence? The rabbis teach, because we define God as a God of benevolence and of giving. God simply wanted us to have the benefit and the pleasure of living and having an association with God. The world came into existence because of chesed, of kindness, and if we want to emulate God, we have to act in such a way as well. If anybody wants to do a little more reading on this, this is a wonderful book with great stories called To Heal a Fractured World. Maybe we'll send this out in the bibliography by Rabbi Jonathan Sachs. And there's just so much literature on this, because it's just a meta issue as far as Judaism is concerned. Any comments, questions, please?
I mean, this is just getting into. Let's talk about courting the bride. So, a lot of them extrapolate from what's been before, but that includes like making a shit up, you know, helping
yes.
the bride to a wedding, and then helping a single person become married.
I mean, that is not included. It's considered very meritorious to bring two people together. In fact, there's some source somewhere, I've never seen it, that says that anyone who sets up three couples that get married, doesn't say they have to stay married, by the way, they just get them married, and can't be responsible for everything, that you get a quick share in the world to come, like no problem. So I think it's probably subsumed under the Hachnasat Kala. It's usually referring to once a couple has met each other, helping them actually get married. And now that I conclude two things. Money, a gift, and number two, there's a lot of stress when two people get engaged. Sometimes people think of breaking it off. Helping support people so that they can make this thing work.
Unless it's the wrong thing.
Unless you really think it's a bad idea.
Does it count for non-Jews also?
All this stuff. So here's the deal with all this. Everything counts for both. Everything counts for both. But there's only an obligation for a fellow Jew. Love thy neighbor and all these things is only obligatory because it says love thy neighbor. Neighbor is defined as a fellow Jew. But my understanding is that the Torah only obligates us for fellow Jews with the goal, ultimately, of just getting into these practices so that you do it for everyone. I would think it's unrealistic for the Torah to command us to behave this way to every human being. The Torah is, I think, a realistic document. It's like, these are the people, this is your family. You're more likely to do this for the family. Start with your family, and hopefully that will spill over. That's my understanding.
So I'm going to a wedding in a few weeks. It says, you know, there's no limits to what one must do to fulfill their requirements. Wedding's on Saturday, so no limits to what one must do to fulfill their requirements. Am I allowed to break Shabbat?
Ooh! What's the answer to that?
Well, it says no limits, but one must do fulfill the requirements.
Right. Does that mean that you can... Well, first of all, why do you need to break the Sabbath in order to go to a wedding?
Well, let's say I did.
You gave me a hypothetical.
No, I cannot put you. I understand.
By the way, it happens all the time. I get this question all the time. It's a real question. So, in general, two wrongs don't make a right. In general, we don't. What's the word I'm using? The ends don't justify the means, I would say. Meaning, we don't just say because the ultimate goal is to do a wedding and therefore anything along the way I can just trample on. We don't believe in that in Judaism. The Talmud says a mitzvah, haba ba'avera, is forbidden. A mitzvah that comes about through the commission of a sin is forbidden.
So it doesn't, so that when it says there are no limits to almost...
Now, that means that there's no limit, meaning that there's usually a measure when it comes to every mitzvah. There's a minimum and there's a maximum. Like charity is supposed to give 10%, not more than 20%. When it comes to these things, you just keep doing them. But that doesn't imply that you can violate other things. That comes up, by the way, with parents. There's a mitzvah to honor your parents. What if a parent tells you to do something that involves breaking the Sabbath, violating Shabbat? So the rabbis discuss this based on the verse. It says in the Torah, Ish imo v'aviv tirao, your mother and your father you shall fear, v'et shabtotai tishvaro, and my Sabbath you shall keep, ani Hashem, I am God. Again, I am God. And the rabbis ask, we already know about Shabbat, why does the verse have to teach us? After it tells you to honor your parents, keep Shabbos, I am God. We've already been told about Shabbos, and we've met God many times already. So it's to teach, the rabbis say, that if a parent would ask a child to do something that would be a violation of Shabbat, you would think maybe you need to do it, because the first part of the verse says, honor your parents. But then the other part of the verse says, keep Shabbos. Well, which do you do? So the third part of the verse answers it. I'm Ani Hashem, I'm God. Meaning the ultimate authority is God. And just like you are obligated, or, you know, if you choose, but we believe that each of us is commanded to fulfill these commandments from God, also your parents are. Now, that doesn't mean that that is a license to be disrespectful. Just because sometimes you may have to disobey a parent. There are times that it's okay to disobey a parent, but there's never a license to be disrespectful in doing so. So, you know, you do not have to listen to everything your parents tell you. Yeah.
I have two questions. What do you do with kind of abusive
yeah,
parents?
Yeah.
And the other one, something you mentioned before, which is, why is not more than 20%? Why is that limited?
So I'll answer the second question first because it's easier.
Okay.
So the rabbis teach that if you give more than 20% of charity, they're concerned that you're going to end up being on the other end, in the receiving end soon. In other words, you're supposed to give, but give within reason. Unless you're Bill Gates, and then you can give 80% and you'll still be okay. You can give 99.9% and you'll still be okay. There's no problem there. But the typical person should try to give 10%, but not more than 20%. So that you don't become in need yourself. The other question is, there is a debate amongst the rabbis as to whether or not abusive parent is still worthy of honor from the child. One rabbi in the Shulchan Aruch says no. They could be, if they were really abusing, especially if they're physically abusing, they would be deemed a rasha, an evil person. And an evil person does not get that honor. Another opinion is, no, they get the honor. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah you have to love your parents, it just says you have to fear and honor them. You still have to do that, but that doesn't mean you don't protect yourself or someone else. You are required, according to Jewish law, if you see a child being beaten, or let's say you're a sibling and your younger brother, God forbid, you call the authorities, even if it means you're putting your parents in jail, you testify against your parents. That is permissible under Jewish law. It's required. Because self-preservation, self-defense, it comes first, even before honoring parents. So the question is, how much does it apply? You're asking about physical abuse, emotional abuse, then it starts getting a little gray.
I'm thinking about perhaps not such a small child, but teenager or something like that, and I would think that it's kind of a natural reaction to react to that.
Right.
I don't have the exact words, but react to that in not honoring them.
Right.
And so is that kind of wrong?
Right. So in general, we try to behave not only according to our feelings. That's like a crazy idea in our society today. Everything's about the way we feel. You ever hear last time somebody said, what do you think? People always ask, how do you feel? Everything is about our feelings. Judaism really is is a value-driven path in life. So even if you might feel a certain way, the Torah might challenge you to overcome the feelings and still behave in a different way. The question is, though, you might not have to, though, because the parent might have made themselves unworthy of honor or fear, which are the two things a child's supposed to give a parent. Fear, by the way, doesn't mean like you're afraid of your parent. Fear is reverence. That when a parent walks in the room, you're supposed to stand up. You're not supposed to call your parent by their first name. You're not supposed to sit in their seat unless you have permission. It's reverence. Honor, by the way, is very interesting. The Talmud says honor means you lead your parents in, you clothe, and you feed them, referring to when parents get older and what child is supposed to take care of their parents. So they're very specific things. It doesn't say anywhere in the Torah you have to love them or even like them. But you have to behave in a certain way. The question is, if the parent really becomes evil, they can be termed evil because they're abusing their child, then according to some opinions, they no longer are worthy of that.
That's another thing. You mentioned this self-preservation thing. And for me, when it comes to all of these things, one important question is, what extent, you know, you have a natural tendency. For example, it would be ridiculous to expect someone not to go for self-preservation.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's obviously like an attempt to keep those natural drives, let's say, in check.
Sure.
And of course, if you try to go to put them in check too much, that's probably bad. So
you need a good therapist. I mean that because in order to keep certain things in check, you need an outlet.
It's not me specifically that I
know. I know, you have a good friend. You have a friend. Everybody has a friend. no, you do. It
no,
depends.
I think this is relevant for many discussions.
Of
right?
course.
Like,
of course. And the question is when the abuse becomes emotional, then again becomes a little grayer. At what point can the child just abandon the parent and say, it's unhealthy for me emotionally to spend time with my parents? You know, you still have an obligation to be with them. But the question is, how bad is the abuse? And what is the nature of the abusee, the person being abused? How detrimental is this? How much can they handle? That's why you need a third party. I have a friend actually who's a rabbi, and his focus is honoring parents. He's become like a scholar on Jewish law. He's written a few books on honoring parents. They're all in Hebrew, though, so it doesn't help most of us. But it's a big area in Jewish law, because honoring parents obviously is very, very important.
I didn't mean that just in the context of honoring parents, but you know, in the context of many other contexts, let's say. You know, when this idea of perhaps Tikkun Olam is taken to an extreme where to some extent it's denying the self, right? So, it's like if you even consider yourself, perhaps you're a racist, Nazi, misogynist, I don't know what else, right? It's like, perhaps I was, I went too far.
No, but yeah.
Sometimes there's this... It's okay.
Well, the one thing you brought up, which is very relevant, is how much of yourself do you have to sacrifice to help others? I mean, if it's so important to save the world, then why are we sitting here in New York City and just worried about our own living? Maybe we should all join the Peace Corps and save the world. So there's no such obligation. There's no obligation, according to Judaism, but it would be a great thing if you could take a year off or two to do it. Or spend an hour or two a week and help people who are in need. Chesed is incredibly important. I'll give you one or two quick ideas and I want to take your question. It's a great soup kitchen. If anybody wants to go in Brooklyn, It's a great deep idea. It's called Masvia, and you can go and cut onions or potatoes, or you can be a waiter and just serve people. And it's a fully kosher restaurant that's open for people that don't have the money for a proper meal. It's in Brooklyn. You can just go and visit and volunteer. There are a lot of volunteers. There's another organization called Tomchei Shabbos where you can pick up food and deliver it to poor Jewish people before Shabbat. We think that every Jew in America, in New York, is rich. It's not true. There are a lot of very elderly, poor people who happen to be Jewish. And it doesn't have to be for Jews. It could be for people that are not Jewish. Around the corner, there's a wonderful organization called... Thank you. Where they have lists and lists of elderly, homebound people who are stuck in their apartments and are alone and would love a visit. And you can get their name and do a little training. It's such a wonderful thing to do. I mean, you can go read to kids that are blind. I have friends who do that. I have a friend who goes to Rikers and studies with people, so when they get out of jail, they're not going to be a repeat offender because they can pass their GED test. I mean, there's no end. That's what it means, that there's no end. You know, like, there's just so much chesed that you can do. And the best thing in the world, I didn't talk about this tonight at all, is giving produces happiness. All the studies show that the more you give, the more selfless you are, the happier people we become. Daniel, then we'll break.
You know, when the title of the class, the first thing that popped in my head was what you had started with, speaking a little bit about, and it's a little bit different than what we were talking about, so it's a little bit of a different discussion, but the Jews who take tikkun olam and social justice as nearly the entirety of their religion. This is something that, because you know, I'm in a fairly artistic community, and I come across mm-hmm. people my age, you know, who claim to speak for me as a Jew, with very you know, militant perspectives on social justice in a very liberal context, and in a way that. That goes against the Jewish community's overwhelming support for Zionism and the state of Israel, but it's through social justice and through
right. Anything, you know, anything unchecked that doesn't have a true, in my opinion, Torah perspective can go awry, you know, and it could start with a very pure motive of trying to do good. And you've seen that. There are a lot of different examples of that in history. And unfortunately, we see that a lot in the community. In my opinion, a lot of it's ignorance and the lack of a subtle, a little more sophisticated and subtle understanding, a little more nuanced understanding, I should say, of a very complicated conflict in Israel. And that's not to say that a person who goes off and does volunteer work for Palestinians in refugee camps isn't doing the right thing. I think they are doing the right thing. But to condemn Israel and to hold Israel completely responsible for that kind of situation is just looking, you know, it's just not, in my opinion, not being aware of the facts, of the history. And the problem is, the real problem, in my opinion, when it comes to Zionism is you need to know history, and not just what happened 10 minutes ago, but what happened in the early 1900s, or the first wave of Aliyah, what it was like for Jews to live before there was a state, and the reaction of the Arab world when the state was created, everything before the Six-Day War, when those lands were quote-unquote occupied. Very few people are aware of the history of our people. And I truly believe that if we were more knowledgeable, and we had a broader understanding and a more nuanced understanding of the history, we wouldn't think Israel as evil.
Could you do a session, you know, as one of the, we should put that in.
As part of the basic Judaism.
Yeah. Israel. Yeah, another week,
huh? You could throw one in. I think it's super important. I just was a Skam resident in Brooklyn for Shabbat, and I gave four addresses on Israel. And the lack of, you know, it's just, and by the way, and even after you get all the information, it's still complicated. It's not a black and white situation. Israel, I believe, has been thrust into a very, very difficult situation and has not always acted in the perfect manner. But to consider it immoral and unethical and an occupying force some European colonial kind of occupying force is just to take a little snippet of something people see right here and now, pull it out of context. It's just, and I'm not saying it's always anti-Semitism. I think a lot of it is ignorance. Sometimes it's anti-Semitism. But the point you brought up, Tikkun Olam is a very Jewish thing. It always was a Jewish thing. It's just not the entirety of Judaism. The reason, as I'll tell you also historically, the Reform movement believes theologically that Judaism is not a binding set of laws that Jews are supposed to keep and observe in a regular daily fashion. They believe that Judaism is really a social force for good in the world. And therefore all of these commandments, like not mixing the kid with its mother's milk, doesn't mean you can't eat kosher. The Pittsburgh Platform, which is where the first conference of Reform rabbis took place, they served non-kosher food there at a rabbinic conference. Right? Jackie Mason used to always say that. Mahi Temple was so Reform, it's closed on all the holidays. Right? You know, they used to make jokes about this, but because they believe that Judaism is not a system of laws governing your everyday life. It's a social force of ideas that we just send out to the world. And those ideas are primarily Tikkun Olam. You know, and that's why, you know, listen, that's their version of Judaism. And they reformed it. That's why it's called Reform Judaism. They want it.
Do you have scornful eyes at the Reform movement for...
No, I don't have I don't have scornful eyes out of anyone who does or believes whatever they believe sincerely. As long as they believe that sincerely, that's their understanding. I think they're absolutely wrong. I don't know where they get off changing it, reforming it. You know, I get that, but I don't have scornful eyes. I think, unfortunately, they were promoting assimilation and intermarriage for many decades. Because, again, if it's a social force, then what we want to do is get it out there as much. The problem is, it's not practical. You can't hold on to a group of Jews if you keep telling everybody to assimilate. Then how are you going to be a social force anymore if there's none of us left? That's a real issue. But we can do another class another time also on the difference between the denominations. Because I think it's important to know. And there were some real scholars in the Reform movement. Again, I don't love what they did. I don't agree with it. But when people believe in it and believe that this is what Judaism is, I can't argue with that. That's what they believe. And I think we have to respect each other's beliefs, even if we disagree. But it's a very different understanding of Judaism. Like, I wanted you guys to come out of this class not just saying they're nice, we believe in chesed. The idea is go around the corner and get a name of someone who's elderly and do chesed, right? And be part of, you know, the next time you get invited to a wedding, don't just go in the corner and get smashed and have a good old time. Make sure your friend, who's the groom, has what he needs. Get him something he wants because you're performing a mitzvah. That's the difference. In other words, what does Judaism want of me? What kind of lifestyle should I be living? You know, that I think is different. It was just like nice ideas.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm so sorry I kept you guys late, but you came through the bad weather. We figured we'd give you more. Atara brought out more sushi. So please enjoy your sushi. Next week...
Meditation on prayer.
Awesome.
And the following week is a moral distance. We're not going to be class. The next week is going to be sexuality, and we're actually going to be having a partnership with Moshe House. Where a bunch of them are going to be coming up to learn with us. So just letting you know what's coming up next week.
Awesome. So next week, prayer/meditation, and then you're off, and then sex. Awesome. Great way to end. Please enjoy the sushi and the extra food. It's interesting. You really are exposed to a certain segment of the Jewish population.
This is the thing, Rabbi, is that, you know, because the big question I have is something that I've been struggling with, which is the sect of Jews who don't understand Zionism, and in turn, you know, through a misunderstanding of Zionism, begin to act and associate with very anti-Zionist organizations or individuals, and I struggle with how to love these individuals.
You gotta love them anyway because they don't really know, and I know they think they know. And they would probably be annoyed if you thought, but Well, let me turn this off.